Right, we're going to turn our attention now to the Word of God, reading together in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 28. And we're going to read from verses 2 to 15, which you'll find around page 1000 of the church Bibles. The Bibles themselves are underneath the seats in front of us. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 28, reading from verses 2 through to 15. Simply the next part of the ongoing story of Jesus' death and resurrection that we've been following in Partick Trinity over a number of weeks now, seeking to hear what Matthew has to say. We looked at the last few verses of chapter 27 last Sunday, which really brings us into the story of the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And we looked at that largely with a view to considering the evidence for the resurrection. Did it really happen or not? And looked at the way that Matthew presents that for us, how he says Jesus really did die on the cross. Folks recognized him there when they were making fun of him, so it wasn't an imposter. It really was Jesus. He really did die. The Roman execution squad made sure of that, and he was placed in the same tomb that was empty on the third day. The woman saw him being placed in and saw afterwards that he had come out of the same tomb. And we know it really was empty because Matthew tells us, we'll read in this today's reading, Matthew tells us there were rumors circulating in Jerusalem that the body had been stolen. And there wouldn't have been such rumors if the body was still there. But we also know that it cannot have been stolen because a guard was placed in the tomb to prevent that happening. So Jesus really did rise from the dead. In its favor as a living truth, said Lord Darling, who was once the Lord Chief Justice of England, there exists such overwhelming evidence, positive and negative, factual and circumstantial, that no intelligent jury in the world could fail to bring in a verdict that the resurrection story is true. Or Dr. Simon Greenleaf, professor of law at Harvard, concluded that the resurrection of Christ was one of the best supported events in history, according to the laws of legal evidence administered in courts of justice. Or Edward Clark, King's Counsel. To me, the evidence is conclusive, and over again in the High Court, I have secured the verdict on evidence not nearly so compelling. Inference follows on evidence, and a truthful witness is always artless and disdains effect. The gospel evidence for the resurrection is of this class, and as a lawyer, I accept it unreservedly. As a testimony, universally would be better. As a lawyer, I accept it unreservedly as a testimony of truthful men to facts that they were able to substantiate. I wouldn't claim to be a forensically trained lawyer with that depth of perception, but as I said last Sunday morning, with what I think is a relatively intelligent and rational mind, I just can't summon up enough blind faith to believe any of the speculative, improbable, unsubstantiated alternatives put forward to the simple explanation that Jesus rose. So that was the evidence, the proof that it happened. What I want us to go on to think about this Sunday is its significance. Why does Matthew tell us that Jesus rose from the dead? There are lots of things you could prove that were true, but nobody cares very much about. It's true that I had Singapore fried rice from the Chinese carryout for my tea last night, but I'm not going to preach a sermon about it. Why did Matthew tell us this true thing, that Jesus rose from the dead? That's what I want us to turn our attention to this morning. Not just is it fact or fiction, but what does the Bible have to say? Matthew chapter 8, 28, verse 2. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow. And the guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. And the angel said to the woman, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus, who was crucified. He is not here. He has risen, just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. And then go quickly and tell his disciples, he has risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee, and there you will see him. Now, I have told you." And so the woman hurried away from the tomb, afraid and yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. And suddenly Jesus met them. "Greetings," he said. And they came to him, clasped his feet, and worshipped him. And then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and there they will see me." While the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. And when the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. Amen. And I pray that God will follow with his blessing this reading from his word. When the SNP launched their manifesto recently for the forthcoming Scottish election, and I should make clear that other political parties are also available, but when the SNP launched it, it was Nicola Sturgeon, who was herself a politician, is a politician, flanked by her cabinet ministers, who came up onto the stage to make the announcement. Back at the end of last year, when the BBC was presenting its Sports Personality of the Year award to, was it Andy Murray that won it? I can't remember. I think it was. But it was Gary Lineker, along with other personalities, famous sports personalities, who made the presentation, who introduced and handed over the prize. Gary Lineker, an England international football player. And when the Brit Awards for the pop music industry, held in February of this year at the O2 Arena in London, were presented, then again it was Anton Deck, entertainers, who came up onto the stage to introduce the folks who were coming to collect the prizes. So whenever you've got a big presentation to make, whenever you want to make an impact and draw people's attention to the launch of something new, then you need to think about who is going to make that presentation, who is going to represent you and speak in your behalf. So when the resurrection of Jesus Christ was announced to the world, it's interesting that they didn't get, for example, the chairman of the Galilean Trades Guild to make the presentation. Even though Jesus spent, so far as we know, most of his adult life laboring as a carpenter among other working men in Galilee. Nor did they get a famous Jewish rabbi or teacher to come and make the presentation, even though the last 3 years of his life were spent extensively engaged in theological teaching and discussion and argument, something for which he became notorious. They didn't get a world leader to do it either, even though he was accused of being, and to some extent claimed to be, the king of the Jews. And they didn't even do what we might have thought would have been sensible and bring a small child onto the stage, or a blind man, or a prostitute. Even though one of his frequent functions throughout his ministry was to take such people upon whom the world usually looks down and lift them up to the heights of heaven. But when Jesus' resurrection was presented to the world, they got an angel to come and do it. And no ordinary angel at that. There are parts of the Bible when angels appear, for example, to Abraham, and he mistakes them for ordinary human beings. He doesn't know who they are to begin with because they just look normal. And Hebrews chapter 13 verse 2 warns us that we might sometimes entertain angels unawares. Well, you would stand no chance of entertaining this angel unaware, not only because he was dressed in clothes white as snow in a day and generation before Persil and automatic washing machines, but because he looked like lightning. Now, I don't know what someone like lightning looks like, but I'm sure it's striking. So frightened, thank you, Manna. So frightening, the angel appeared, that when he came to the tomb, the guards who had been posted there to guard against anyone approaching it, became like dead men, and so strong that he was able to take the large stone, roll it back, topple it over, and sit down on top of it as if it was a beanbag. An angel of the Lord used in this occasion because resurrection is heaven's business. We need to appreciate that lightning-like, shining white brightness and radiance as part of what we have to come to terms with when we think about the risen Lord. Like the brightness of Moses' face when he came out of the tent of meeting in the Old Testament and had to wear a veil over the front of it so that he wouldn't dazzle the other people that he met with the reflection of the Lord's glory. Or like Solomon's temple in 2 Chronicles, when he prays his prayer of dedication and all the priests are in there doing their stuff, but they have to run for their lives when the glory of the Lord enters the presence because it's so overwhelming. Or like Jesus himself and the glimpse that three of disciples had of him at the transfiguration when he stopped looking like a Galilean carpenter and began to look, well, shining white was the only way they could describe him. Or in the way that Paul saw him in the road to Damascus, so bright that Jesus blinded him before he even spoke to him. Or like the vision that John had of the risen Lord in the book of Revelation in chapter 1 verse 13, where he saw among the seven golden lampstands someone like a son of man who was dressed in a robe that reached down to his feet and with a golden sash around his chest, and the hair on his head was white as wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were like blazing fire. And his feet were like bronze glowing in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of rushing waters. Resurrection is out of this world. You might know this story from the film Chariots of Fire, the true story of the quarter-mile race that Eric Liddell ran at Stoke-on-Trent in 1923, just before the Olympic final, where he fell at the first bend, tripped over by an Englishman called J.J. Gillis. But Liddell got back onto his feet, and although he was 30 yards behind the rest of the pack, he chased them and caught them, and I'm going to spoil the ending of the video clip by telling them that he crossed the line first, and in spite of having fallen, he won the prize that he would have won if everything had gone according to the original plan. Well, I think sometimes we think of the resurrection as being a bit like that, that after making a good start, Jesus tripped up. He came crashing down. He was crucified. But he was able to get back up again and carry on doing what he'd been doing before. And that's our picture of resurrection. The same Jesus who was crucified has come back to life again. And that's halfway towards the truth. But suppose instead of getting back up to run again at the first bend of the quarter mile race, Eric Liddell had instead jumped into Lewis Hamilton's Formula One racing car and sped round the rest of the track at 250 miles an hour, passing the others still halfway up the back straight and winning the race by 200 meters. Well, your first inclination might have been to try and disqualify him. But if at the time he was flanked by an angel looking like lightning, you might have given him the prize anyway. And that would be more like the resurrection. Jesus rises to glory in the heavenly realms, and shining angels are his proper companions. And works of incredible strength and mighty power are just normal for him. And terrorizing is the natural impact that he has on people. And those who before his resurrection thought that they could arrest him and beat him or buy him and sell him or imprison him and entomb him or contain him or control him or even just have some influence upon him and persuade him to do things their way, looking at him now need to think again. And even those who choose to serve him need to realize that we do so not as part-time volunteers, sometimes kindly doing him a favor, but as conscripts whose privilege it is to be in the service of heaven's king. You know the story of the child, don't you? Busy drawing in nursery school, and the teacher did what nursery teachers often have to do and said, "That's a very nice drawing. What is it?" And of course the child said, "I'm drawing a picture of God." And the teacher says, "Well, nobody knows what God looks like." And the child says, "Well, they will once I finish my drawing." One of the commandments says, don't have an image of God. Don't draw a picture because you'll get it wrong. But when we come to the New Testament, we do have pictures of Jesus, and people make films and draw pictures. And if I asked you, therefore, to picture Jesus, then if you'd get past the long hair and the open-toed sandals, you might think of the baby lying in the manger, or the man standing in the boat teaching a crowd of people, or somebody down on his knees with a towel round his waist washing disciples' feet, and all that historically accurate described in the Gospels, so that we could picture it. But if you say, picture Jesus, then it's this picture that we really need to have. The flashing eyes like fire and the lightning like glory and the all-consuming brightness. Picture Jesus almost you can't, because you need to put your sunglasses on or bury your head in the sand, because he's so glorious. He's so beyond this world that it's almost impossible for it to contain him. So we have this Jesus accompanied by angels and yet still human. That's the point the angel is making here. These women have come looking for Jesus, and for them that is the person 3 days ago they were having dinner with, and then who was taken from them and arrested and crucified. So the women have come looking for Jesus, and the angel says 4 things about him to them in verses 5 and 6. This Jesus you are looking for, he says, it was crucified, but is not here. Has risen as he has said. These 4 things all said about Jesus, and the he hasn't changed. Okay, they obviously don't say Jesus was crucified and he's not here and someone else has risen from the dead, as that previous guy Jesus said. It's the same he throughout the story. He who was crucified has risen, and he is now what he said before he would become. So Jesus doesn't leave his humanity behind somewhere between dying and rising from the dead. Nor does he take his existing humanity and tack something else onto it. Some new divine aspect of his being. What Jesus does in rising from the dead, what he does is reveal what humanity should be and could be and is becoming. You see, resurrection describes what happens to people and what Christian faith holds in store for us. And that's why the tomb was empty on Easter Sunday morning, because death and resurrection is not about shedding things or leaving things behind or even losing limitations. It's about taking what is, who we are, what we can do, and amplifying and magnifying, if you like, completing and fulfilling all of the Creator's intention from the beginning. And that's what Jesus is doing here. Remember all those signs of the kingdom of God that have been characteristic of his ministry during his life on earth before his death and resurrection. Remember all those blind people who were made able to see, because God doesn't want people to be blind. And all those deaf people who began to hear, and the lame men who were walking and carrying their mats about the place, because God didn't want them lying in the ground. Remember those demon-possessed people who were insane and frothing at the mouth and frightening people, now included in society because Jesus had driven the demons out of them. And the outcasts who were welcomed in and given a place of honor, a seat at the front of the room. All that ignorance which was blown away by the wisdom of Jesus' teaching, because God doesn't want people not to understand. All the hungry who were fed, all the wealth that was properly directed, because God doesn't want a privileged few to lord it over the others. All the integrity and humility that was respected, because God doesn't want a bunch of smart alecks thinking they've got it right. And all the worship that was thoughtfully directed and focused on God. All of that is the way it should be. And in Jesus' life on earth, we get glimpses of it becoming, of it happening, which are foretastes of heaven. What the kingdom of God will be when the will of God is done on earth as it is in heaven. And now with resurrection, heaven's human being and human king who took on flesh when the word became flesh and whose flesh was pierced by nails and a spear has now come again in glory, not less human than us, but as human as we will become when we are raised with him. So we have the heavenly glory of a resurrected humanity, and yet still in continuity with the life that he lived before. And that continuity is emphasized when the two Marys meet Jesus in verse 9. Suddenly Jesus met them and said, "Greetings." Now that word greetings is just the absolutely ordinary, most banal, mundane, thoughtless comment you would chuck out at someone you half recognized when you pass them in the street. There's nothing unusual about it at all. What was the first word that Jesus said when he rose from the dead? It was, "Hi there." And that's it. And yet the woman didn't say to one another, "Who's that standing over there? Have you seen him before?" They didn't say, "I vaguely recognize him. He looks a bit like someone I used to know." Because they knew who it was, just as he knew who they were. And so he calls out to them, how are you doing? Not too proud in his resurrected state to have to do with those who have not yet followed him there. And though their reaction quite properly is to fall on their feet and worship him because that's what you do in the presence of God, they still recognize the one at whose feet they fall as Jesus, more clearly seen perhaps now than ever before, but not less well known. Now I wonder if you grab the significance of that. These women knew Jesus when he had risen from the dead. Don't people sometimes wonder if we will know one another in the life to come? How can that be? And there are practical problems that we can't begin to understand. If we're going to be completely transformed, how can we still be recognizable? How can a grandparent in their 90s be recognized by their own grandparents who last saw them when they were a baby or a small child, and also be recognized by their own grandchildren who will themselves be transformed beyond recognition over the generations? Or if individuals have changed, as thank goodness some of us have, not only in appearance but also in personality over the years, which bit of us, which snapshot will be crystallized for all eternity? A person that used to be grumpy and bad-tempered but has now become much more easygoing, or vice versa, I dare suggest it sometimes. Which of them are you going to recognize in glory? Some people we know so well by their faults, you almost wouldn't recognize them if they became better people. And we ourselves are. Do you not sometimes feel that your own shortcomings are so much a part of you that while you long for the cleansing of death and resurrection, when all the faults and all the failures are swept away and forgotten about, it seems as though it must be almost like a computer having its memory wiped and restarted with a factory reset so that you go from the beginning again? But if that ever happens to your computer, you don't recognize it when it's switched back on because all your own settings have gone. And there's lots of how questions that we're not equipped to answer because God doesn't tell us what we don't need to know. But what he does tell us here is that he's not going to start all over again. That however much there is indeed that's wrong with us, there's also a good deal which is of lasting value. And our God, whose name is love, and whose character is faithfulness, is not about to start eternity by breaking relationships and making them as if they had never been before. So the two Marys know the risen Lord. And when he sees them, he greets them. And the starting point of heaven and earth is an embrace. So if you want to think of heaven as an eternal group hug and family reunion, then biblically, not just in your imagination, but biblically, you're not far wide of the mark. And if, like me, you're one of these people who are not too sure that hugging is a good thing, that will be one of the things that's changed. So that's heaven for you. That's the resurrection. The sobering fact is that in the midst of all this power displayed and love demonstrated, there remains incredibly determined opposition to the truth that has been blasted across the earth like lightning. While the women went on their way in verse 11, Matthew goes off in the other direction with some of the guards who go into the city. And there we see them colluding with elders and priests to proclaim what they know can't be true. How does that happen? Take the Jewish authorities, first of all, the ones who posted the guard. They know better than anyone that the theft of the body is the one absolutely impossible explanation. However you put all the facts that are established in front of them, the body cannot have been stolen. But because they can't come up with any other explanation for what happened, and because they are absolutely determined that Jesus is not going to turn out to be the risen Lord, the Son of God, and the Lord's Messiah, they are the ones who cling with blind faith to what cannot be true. It's faith in that silly sense of the word that people sometimes accuse Christian faith of being, where it's in the face of the evidence. That's the kind of faith you have here. With blind faith in what cannot be true, and with blind faith like that, which is so common in our world today, it's human nature, where people lie to themselves to denounce true Christian faith rather than giving house room or headspace to God's revelation. That's what happens. People so blind that they just will not see. But what about the guards themselves? Remember, they'd just seen an angel who looks like lightning, who'd made them shake with fear and then terrified and paralyzed them. Surely that would be an absolutely life-transforming experience. No one to whom that had happened could ever be the same again. They'd seen the angel of the Lord. I imagine that when the angel appeared, they probably prayed, because that's what even atheists do in those situations. And probably they said, "Dear God, I'm terribly sorry for all the things I've ever done wrong. I will do whatever you want for the rest of my life if you'll only let me live." And within a few hours, they have confronted the cynical disbelief of their elders and betters, the Jewish chief priests and elders. And so they exchange for a bribe their spiritual awakening, and life goes back to normal again. And I know, as I'm sure you do too, that there are people today who have done the same thing, who have described to you or described to me the deeply moving personal spiritual experiences that they have had and would describe themselves as personal encounters with the living God. And now they have persuaded themselves that it never really happened. And maybe there's folks here like that as well. And then last of all, there is the people of Jerusalem who are circulating the rumors in verse 15. The guards started it by telling their story, but the people of Jerusalem passed it on. The disciples came and stole the body. What rumors need to circulate, of course, is not truth to back them up, but rather sensational entertainment value. And derogatory rumors about people you don't like anyway are especially easy to believe and pass on. You know how you do it. You say, "I'm not sure whether this is true, but I heard." And by the time you get to the juicy bits, nobody's heard the first bit. So the rumors are passed on. So Christian people today are known for a fact by many people to be narrow-minded, unscientific, anti-enjoyment, socially manipulative, and people know that because they've been told it. And they don't stop to ask how those people who told them knew that it was true, any more than the people of Jerusalem said to the guards, "How do you know the disciples came and stole the body while you were what? Asleep. You know what happened in your bedroom last night while you were asleep? Neither do I." But you don't need to know if you've got a rumor, because people just enjoy telling the tale, and denouncing traditional organized religion is too good a story to spoil with the facts. And we need to make sure we don't fall into that trap too. And actually, it's a growing Christian trait that we value our own brand of Christianity, our own personal experience, but we like to kind of step outside of the box. And here's me and Jesus here, and the church is over there, and there's a lot of rubbish and nonsense in there that doesn't work properly. Is that true? Or is it just what's been said? One day, all such people will be silenced. The blind bigots, those who've sold their souls, and the wishful thinkers will all be silenced, just like those guards were silenced, terror-struck like dead men, because they got in the angel's way. Because there will be no lying when Christ returns, and no forgetting, and no denying. But what we need to remember and finish with is this, that what the angel said to the woman is, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. Now, he doesn't say that to the guards. So the message is not to say there's nothing scary about the risen Lord. That anyone who's afraid of him hasn't properly understood him. That inside Jesus is really just cuddly and you've just got to get past that slightly sparky, lightning-like nature. He doesn't say that at all. The guards have every reason to be afraid, and paralyzed with fear is how the angel leaves them. Do not be afraid. The angel said to the woman, because I know that you are looking for Jesus. We have an awesome God who hates sin, detests lies, abominates prejudice, eliminates injustice, and obliterates arrogance, but whose very being is a promise that whoever seeks him will find. Whoever loves him is loved. And whoever believes is already saved. Was crucified, but no longer dead, is raised and has said, come to me and I will give you rest. May God follow with his blessing the word of the risen Lord.